Hello there. Today is Thursday, July the 6th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Obama makes a big announcement about U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Outrage from video showing a black man shot by police.
The individuals involved in his murder took away a man with children.
Hillary Clinton's email troubles continue to haunt her campaign. How the Islamic State group is trying to stay relevant online. Also ahead, it's the hottest thing for American meals since ketchup. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, a day after the director of the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigations announced that Hillary Clinton will not face criminal charges over her emails, angry House Republicans are summoning FBI Director James Comey to Capitol Hill later today to answer their questions. He will testify before the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee. House Speaker Paul Ryan telling reporters on Wednesday that it looks like Clinton got preferential treatment.
Director Comey's presentation shredded the claims that Secretary Clinton made throughout the year with respect to this issue. He laid out a case how the things she had been saying she had or had not done were false.
Let's talk more about this with congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Catherine, Republicans not going to let this go even after it was announced there'd be no charges.
That's absolutely right. So we heard this 1-2 punch from House Republicans. Speaker Ryan coming out at his weekly newser saying that Hillary Clinton did not deserve to have access to classified material. He called on the Director of National Intelligence to actually limit her ability to access that material. And that was right after we heard from the House Oversight Committee, who said that they would be bringing in the FBI Director, James Comey, to testify before their committee about that investigation.
Obviously, this is not something the Clinton campaign had hoped to be talking about after she was cleared of any criminal charges. That's not the case. And now we have a hearing on Capitol Hill. What are we expecting there with that?
The Clinton campaign thought that they had put this story to rest by the announcement that the investigation had reached its conclusion, that there would be no criminal charges. But by calling the FBI director in to testify, House Republicans keep this story going. They keep it in the news for another couple of days. And of course, we know that the Attorney General, Loretta Lynch, will be called in to testify as well, most likely next week. And so that means that we'll still be talking about this issue in the campaign context, at least until next week.
And we are really just a couple of weeks now from the Democratic National Convention. I'm sure that this is not a topic they would like to be discussing at this point.
Oh, absolutely not. Although the House of Representatives does go out of session next Friday, everybody gets a break, assuming that they all will eventually, you know, go to their respective conventions, the Republicans and the Democrats. So there will be a little bit of a lull on Capitol Hill in terms of action on this issue.
And Donald Trump, listen to what he had to say about all of this.
I mean, she's crooked Hillary. That's all you have to know. She's crooked as hell.
Donald Trump has often made salacious statements, and now he's making an accusation that really has no proof, but he's accusing Hillary Clinton of bribing the attorney general. Those are some pretty strong words. Is this just more of Donald Trump being Donald Trump?
It certainly is more of Donald Trump being Donald Trump and saying the things that he feels open and free to say that really haven't been said in other election cycles. I mean, it is pretty extraordinary to think that the Republican presidential nominee is accusing the Democratic presidential nominee of bribing the attorney general, who's one of the chief law enforcement officers of the United States. In terms of this email scandal, it's pretty extraordinary when you think about that and take a step back. Of course, this also plays into a narrative that Donald Trump has emphasized throughout his campaign, is that the system is rigged. And that really does resonate with a lot of voters across the country who are tired of politics as is, who think that Hillary Clinton represents an old, corrupt system of government that isn't in touch with their needs, that's just out to get whatever they want and need. So really, this does in a lot of ways play into Donald Trump's strengths. He gets to say again and again, the system is rigged.
Once the FBI, though, has made that decision, regardless of what the FBI director has to say on Capitol Hill. Are there any further ramifications that Hillary Clinton could see besides the fact that this just doesn't look good, that we're still talking about it?
Well, you know, it does play into the problem that she has in terms of negative numbers. We have these two presidential candidates who have some of the highest negative numbers ever of any presidential candidates. And yet again, we see the issues of trust and authenticity and credibility that have been issues for Hillary Clinton throughout her public career and that she had hoped would be put aside and set behind her. And unfortunately are not, and are going to linger in the minds of many voters who have some questions about that.
And Clinton, for her part, made no mention of the email issue whatsoever on Wednesday. Instead, she was in Atlantic City pointing out Donald Trump's casino bankruptcies.
And here's what he says about the whole experience. He actually brags about it. Atlantic City was a very good cash cow for me for a long time. The money I took out of there was incredible. Think about it. The money he took out of here. That says everything you need to know about Donald Trump. It's not about what he can build. It's about how much he can take.
So this is one of the things that Donald Trump likes to say makes him a successful candidate and would make him a successful president, is that he's successfully run businesses. So it really plays to Hillary Clinton's strengths to be able to go out there, stand in front of these failed casinos and say, look, he actually isn't as successful as he says he is. He's had these string of failures. He's had these bankruptcies. Why would you trust him when he goes out and says?
All right. Well, that was VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson reporting. Thanks so much. We now turn to our social media segment. International Edition's G. Abby Lee joins us. G, there's a new development online regarding some of Donald Trump's posts on Twitter.
Hi, Lori. It's been a few days since Donald Trump tweeted a meme targeting his Democratic rival, Hillary Clinton. But it seems like people are not going to stop talking about it anytime soon.
So, as a refresher, It showed a picture of the presumptive Democratic nominee with the words, "the most corrupt candidate ever," and that was inside a six-pointed red star.
That's right. And because the meme originates from a white supremacist website, many people believe it to be a Star of David and therefore anti-Semitic. Now, to do damage control, his family got involved, and specifically his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. He's the husband of Trump's beloved daughter, Ivanka Trump. He's Jewish, and he's the owner of the newspaper New York Observer. So he's really the perfect candidate to speak up against allegations of racism that Trump has been suffering for some time now. Ivanka Trump actually converted to Judaism when she married Kushner.
What did he say?
In his own newspaper, he wrote an opinion piece titled "The Donald Trump I Know," and The Observer tweeted a link to the article. It's currently the pinned tweet on its Twitter page at Observer. Basically, he wrote, Donald Trump is not anti-Semitic and is not a racist. This piece is more or less a response to one of his employees' accusations. Observer's writer, Dana Schwartz, had criticized her employer for supporting Trump. Schwartz tweeted a lot about Kushner's piece, and here's an example. She wrote, at least Jared Kushner didn't pretend it was a sheriff's star. Trump had previously said the six-pointed star is a sheriff's star, which also has 6 points. Back to you, Lori.
All right, thanks so much, G. You can follow her at G. Abby Lee. Here are some of the other stories we're following at voanews.com. For the first time, U.S. sanctions on Kim Jong-un for human rights abuses. The U.S. gun control debate at center stage in Washington again. The U.N. calls for the release of U.S. women detained in China. A phone call between Obama and Putin on world hotspots. And a song tribute to victims of the massacre in Orlando, Florida, featuring Britney Spears, J-Lo, and Mary J. Blige. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, as the security situation continues to worsen in Afghanistan, President Barack Obama on Wednesday announced plans to maintain 8,400 U.S. troops there through the end of his presidency on January 20th, 2017.
The decision I'm making today ensures that my successor has a solid foundation for continued progress in Afghanistan, as well as the flexibility to address the threat of terrorism as it evolves.
The administration had initially planned to reduce the number of U.S. troops from the current 9,800 to around 5,500 by the end of 2016. VOA's Ira Melman asked our White House correspondent Mary Alice Salinas how hard of a decision this was for President Obama.
It wasn't an easy one. As you know, he ran, even as a senator, running for the White House, promising to end these wars. And here he is, really in the final months of his presidency, saying, well, I was going to draw down the number of troops to 5,500, but we're going to go and leave him at 8,400. That's because it's a mess. The security situation is worsening. The Taliban is surging back. We have Islamic State trying to really set a foothold there, finding it so unstable that it is a good place for, as you know, Islamic State to move to, try to set up another, you know, home base. And then you have al-Qaeda elements that are still there and still continuing to cause problems, and that's a key priority for America. It really is a very difficult situation, and again, he's going to go to NATO later this week and try to get commitment from coalition partners, and he just has a few months left in office. So it's not good.
As you heard, he has asked the Taliban to come to the negotiating table. What's the latest status on that?
Well, really, no real progress has been made on that. There is also tremendous dissatisfaction with the new leadership in some of the latest polls among Afghanis and their new, you know, president and their chief executive. And so no real reform or major progress has been made in that area. And so this is just another one of the elements that the next president will have to deal with. It's security situation. It's a lack of political reform. It is still a notoriously corrupt government. You have refugees problems there. You have infrastructure problems that continue. The economy is just in a shambles. That's why there's a lot of criticism here. And the president has said, I continue to tweak my approach toward Afghanistan based on what my team, military and intelligence team, tells me, but it's you can't argue that it's a resounding success, although the administration does say progress has been made.
White House correspondent Mary Alice Salinas. Meanwhile, a long-awaited report on Britain's involvement in the Iraq War is critical of the arguments that led to that invasion. Former British civil servant John Chilcott led the inquiry, which looked at the intelligence on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction.
We have concluded that the UK chose to join the invasion of Iraq before the peaceful options for disarmament had been exhausted.
The report also concluded that former British Prime Minister Tony Blair overstated the threat posed by Saddam Hussein. After hearing the report findings, Blair did express sorrow and regret, but disputed some claims.
It's claimed by some that by removing Saddam, we caused the terrorism today in the Middle East, and that it would have been better to have left him in power. I profoundly disagree.
The inquiry took 7 years to publish. Well, military setbacks in Iraq and Syria are having little impact on the Islamic State terror group's ability to gain ground in cyberspace, where it has dramatically advanced both the quality and volume of its messaging, according to top law enforcement and diplomatic officials. I talked about it with VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden. Jeff?
Islamic State's media wing, Al-Fur Khan, issued a new video, almost 15 minutes long. It's the first video that this wing, which again first came to attention when it started releasing the videos of beheadings, like of U.S. journalist James Foley, which really one of the events that brought Islamic State to international attention. It's the first one it's released in several months. They've released some audio just about a month ago, but this is the first new video. and it's called The Structure of the Caliphate. It's narrated in English, and it talks about how the caliphate is set up, but it talks about the images are almost as important in the words, especially at the beginning, where it's trying to portray this caliphate that's thriving. You see Islamic State fighters dressed, you know, in their fatigues, you know, with their guns, but they're walking down roads, they're smiling. In one sequence, you see a soldier picking up a young child and tossing him in the air like he's his son, and they're both smiling. And the narrator talks about how, under Allah's providence, the Islamic State has been able to establish itself for the believers, how the sun isn't going to set on the Islamic State, how it's going to endure, it's going to last. And then it starts talking about how the government is set up, how it has its committee and its bureaus, its departments that oversee all these different facets of life. And if it's talking about public works, it shows construction, it shows streets being repaired, it talks about money. You see all this cash. He talks about a lot of this is overblown, that even the stuff that may be factual,
it's propaganda, is that what you're saying?
It's very much propaganda. They're really trying to put a lot of spin on a self-declared caliphate that most military officials, most U.S. officials, intelligence officials, analysts say is really on its heels. It's really suffering. It's losing territory. But it's presenting a completely different image.
Well, it doesn't seem like it when you consider all the terror attacks recently that we've been seeing. How effective is this kind of propaganda in their efforts?
There are fears, and government officials were saying this again on Wednesday, that this type of propaganda can be extremely effective, that it is finding an audience, and that, in fact, even as one of the executive assistant directors at the FBI, Michael Steinbach, testified before a Senate committee, it was about Islamic State messaging. But he said that for all the ground that Islamic State is losing in Iraq and Syria, as it's being squeezed out of that space, it is simply putting a lot of energy into cyberspace, into the online realm, where it is finding ways to get out this propaganda that is resonating with violent extremists, men or their women, and it's going to resonate with them somehow, and then they're going to act on it. The concern, of course, for the FBI, for the Department of Homeland Security, are those who are going in the U.S. who are going to see this, be inspired, and then try to carry out a plot, act violently in some way. But it's a major concern because it's available, people can see it, and it does seem to have an impact.
So even when we push them out of certain places, as long as there is internet and they have a way to spread their message, they still have the ability to expand.
One of the things that a number of former counterterrorism intelligence officials are concerned about is the idea of perhaps Islamic State almost morphing. And some say it's probably overblown. It's more likely that if Islamic State loses its caliphate in Iraq and Syria, because its identity has so much been tied to that land, it's going to eventually disappear. It may be overtaken by another jihadist organization. Perhaps it will be absorbed by al-Qaeda or its Syrian affiliate, Jabhat al-Nusra, but it won't exist as is. Others, though, fear that it will become almost a ghost caliphate, a cyber caliphate, and not be so much an organization that holds territory, but a movement online that is able to continually use a network, use this type of messaging online to inspire and make sure that there's a never-ending drumbeat of attacks against the West and other targets in the Arab world, which Islamic State wants to hit.
Jeff Seldon, VOA national security correspondent, we appreciate it. The U.S. Justice Department Civil Rights Division is leading an investigation into the fatal police shooting of an African-American man outside of a convenience store on Tuesday in the southern city of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. The video shows one of two officers shooting 37-year-old Alton Sterling, a father of five, while he was pinned to the ground. Governor John Bel Edwards said the Justice Department will be assisted by the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
Based on the information that I have obtained from law enforcement, but certainly the footage that I observed of the video that was made available, I have very serious concerns. The video is disturbing, to say the least.
With the man's teenaged son sobbing beside her, Sterling's widow, Quinyetta McMillan, spoke to reporters about the heartbreak her family is experiencing.
The individuals involved in his murder took away a man with children who depended upon their daddy on a daily basis. My son is not the youngest. He is the oldest of his siblings. He is 15 years old. He had to watch this as this was put all over the outlet.
Well, the video has sparked protests and calls for the dismissal of the town's police chief. Police have not said what led to the escalation. Sterling suffered multiple gunshot wounds to the chest and back. According to the autopsy report, he died at the scene. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
I'm Victor Beatty. Since 1942, the Voice of America has been a consistently reliable and authoritative source of news. Today, VOA remains committed to providing an accurate, objective, and comprehensive news product at the top of every hour, every day. We can be heard on your local affiliate or streamed on the web at voanews.com.
VOA's International Edition continues. A coastal city in Thailand has become a household name in America thanks to a chili sauce that's now nearly as ubiquitous as ketchup. But as VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from Sriracha, the city's namesake condiment can leave a strange taste there.
It's great on anything.
For millions of Americans, sriracha sauce is something between an obsession and an addiction. There are sriracha sauce cookbooks. The red jalapeno paste is lauded in song.
Oh, it may look peculiar, don't let the bottle fool you. It's Hoi Phong Sriracha, the American garlic chili pepper sauce.
The most popular brand in America has no connection with the city of Sriracha, and none of its ingredients come from Thailand. It was created in the 1980s by David Tran, an ethnic Chinese from Vietnam who emigrated to California.
Every chef has got a bottle in the refrigerator. I don't care what they tell you.
Sriracha, how much Sriracha do we go through? Six bottles a week.
But Thais can be disillusioned when they discover a sriracha sauce manufactured 13,000 kilometers away.
What do you mean it's from America? Its name is Sriracha.
Yeah, because it's a name. It's obviously that should be from Thailand.
We decided to carry out a taste test, bringing a bottle of the California concoction to Sriracha to gauge how well it translates to local tongues.
This American one is way saltier and spicier, but the Thai sauce is more sweet and sour.
I prefer our traditional Thai sauce, as its flavor is more mellow, well-rounded and smooth. The American one has some flavor, but it's sharp, strong, and not well-rounded.
There are several dueling claimants in Thailand to the original sriracha sauce. But one thing on which discerning palates here agree, the American sauce in the green capped red bottle with the white rooster has flown off in a different culinary direction. Steve Herman, VOA News, Sriracha, Thailand.
Well, in entertainment news, GLAAD and Interscope Records have joined forces to release a song featuring Britney Spears, Jennifer Lopez, and Mary J. Blige in tribute to the victims of last month's massacre in Orlando, Florida. Hands was released on Wednesday on iTunes. It also includes Selena Gomez, India, Imagine Dragons, Pink, RuPaul, Meghan Trainor, Gwen Stefani, and more. And sales will benefit the Equality Florida Pulse Victims Fund, among others. Leslie Odom Jr. is riding a wave of success as Aaron Burr, the rival to Lin-Manuel Miranda's Alexander Hamilton in the smash musical Hamilton. David Byrd, VOA's David Byrd, has more.
The falling leaves drift by my window.
Leslie Odom Jr. is riding a wave of success.
As Aaron Burr, the rival to Lin-Manuel Miranda's Alexander Hamilton in the smash musical Hamilton, Odom won the Tony for Best Leading Actor in a Musical. But now he is leaving the blockbuster show and has just released his self-titled jazz album. It includes 10 classic songs, including Jerome Kern's Look for the Silver Lining, Jules Stein's The Party's Over, and Joey, Joey, Joey from Frank Lesser. Odom says he wanted to create something that would not only entertain people, but would also lift their spirits.
Because as an actor, especially through this Hamilton process, you know, I've thought about empathy more this year than at any other time in my life. And so there was a consciousness about singing something that might encourage somebody at a really hard time.
The actor, singer, and dancer said one of his favorite tunes is Nobody Knows You When You're Down and Out, a blues standard written in 1923 by Jimmy Cox and covered by such greats as Bessie Smith, B.B. King, and Eric Clapton.
You know, Nobody Knows You When You're Down and Out was one of my favorite songs on the thing. And I loved singing it now because I'm so far from down and out. And so I feel like, but I remember being down and out so well.
Mighty strange, but without a doubt.
Well, you have been listening to International Edition. We are so glad you could join us. Find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Mark Ferguson. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A decade ago, reaching international consensus on an ambitious climate accord would have been deemed impossible, said U.S. Ambassador to India Richard Verma recently in Hyderabad. But in Paris last December, the global community, thanks in part to Indian leadership, did exactly that. 196 countries came together to reach an historic agreement that seeks to limit global warming to well below 2 degrees centigrade from pre-industrial levels and to pursue efforts to limit it to 1.5 degrees. In April, leaders from around the world, including India's Environment Minister Prakash Javadekar, gathered in New York for the signing ceremony. Despite the progress we have made, Ambassador Verma cautioned, there is still much more to be done. Written by hundreds of scientists from every corner of the world, the most recent assessment report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change unequivocally states that human influence on the climate system is real, and recent emissions of greenhouse gases are the highest in the history of humankind. According to NASA, 2015 was the hottest year on record. In fact, of the hottest years on record, 15 out of 17 have occurred since 2000. The good news, Ambassador Verma noted, is that Prime Minister Modi and President Obama clearly recognize the grave threat posed by climate change and the importance of our two countries working together to combat it. And President Obama recognizes the U.S. role in creating this problem and our responsibility to take action. This includes supporting India's Paris commitment to reduce the emissions intensity of its GDP by approximately 33%, reducing deforestation and repopulating forests, working together to amend the Montreal Protocol to facilitate an ambitious phase down of hydrofluorocarbons, and encouraging swift movement by the global community to bring the Paris Agreement into force. But governments can only do so much, said Ambassador Verma. The real champions of change are youth leaders, civil society, and entrepreneurs, people like yourselves.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.